Okay. We'll start where we should start. Well, we already started where we should start, and that's at the throne of grace. And then what should always be the second start, the second step, is to the scriptures. So I'm going to read Daniel 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king." Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Okay. Now, If you've gone through the notebook, not necessarily answered all the questions, but if you've read through, I said notebook, if you've read through the workbook, chapter 1, on this, and then started working your way through the questions, you'll notice that he divides this chapter up into three sections. Verses 1 through 7, verses 8 through 16, and verses 17 through 20. And that is a very common way to divide it. Just about every single commentator and analysis of Daniel that I've, Daniel 1 that I've looked at, they divide it up the same way. Because the story itself lends itself that way, right? First seven verses is regarding the exile and the deportation of the first wave of Jewish exiles. Verses 8 through 16 is about the training program that they're putting some of the youths through, and how Daniel and his friends respond to that. And then verses 17 through 20 is the results of that training. But I'm wondering, as you guys spent time in chapter 1 and reading through it, if there's something else, there's a key phrase there that's repeated three times in chapter 1. And lo and behold, it's near the beginning of each of those three sections. Almost as if Daniel was deliberately arranging his material around that phrase. Did you catch that phrase? I figured you would. There you go. Two words. God gave. Notice in verse 2, God gave Jehoiakim and temple vessels into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 9, God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And notice that the sentence that's contained in, what God gave, is the leading idea of each of those three sections, right? So he really did arrange his material around that phrase. What do you think he's trying to get across? Well, wait a minute. I think I'm skipping ahead. No, maybe I didn't. What do you think Daniel is trying to get across by doing that? The authority element, absolutely. Provision. Yeah, absolutely. God's giving them. God's got authority. Probably Jehoiakim didn't feel like he was given favor. But certainly the four youths felt like they, you know, felt God's provision for them. Anybody else? That he's in control? Absolutely. Because he has all authority, he's controlling everything, right? Exactly. Just like Julie was saying last week. Anything else? I mean, all of this is right. There's one other thing that I want to point out here with you. And maybe it's best seen by putting yourselves... I've got to learn to stay here. By putting yourselves in the shoes, or probably the sandals, of those four youths. Remember, we said last week they were probably about 14 or 15 years old when they were deported. These Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, when they were deported. So 14 or 15 year olds. Who in our church, who would we be talking about? 14 or 15 year olds. No names? You? Is that what you said, Mary? Are there names that come to mind? Yeah, 13 and 15, Samantha and Lily.
Chris is 14.
Chris is? Well, I act like a 15-year-old a lot of times. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes it helps just to start calling to mind people, that kids that you know that are that age. So we're talking about that young of kids, right? I know it doesn't seem young when you've seen him grow up from infancy. It doesn't seem that young to parents. But listen, I like the way that Golden Gate, even though he's a liberal commentator, I like the way that he describes these events from the perspective of these four youths. He's trying to get across at how overwhelmed those four youths must have felt like. And he says, this is his description: a group of young Israelites, for the moment silent, faceless, nameless, helpless objects for manipulating by the Babylonian state, are to be taken, taught, provided for, trained, and renamed in this alien environment, trundled off to a foreign land. They are placed in the charge of a foreign official with a foreign name, are called by foreign titles, and are allocated a foreign education, foreign diet, and foreign names for themselves to prepare them to serve in a foreign court. Now, think about that describing Chris and Ian and Sam, right? Can you imagine how overwhelmed they would be? So the other thing, that little phrase God gave, that he used to arrange the whole first chapter. Let me ask this question first. I almost gave it away. Let me ask this question. If you were one of those youths, if you were Chris or Ian or Sam, and that description was of you, how would you feel? Besides overwhelmed, I already said that was my contribution. How would you feel? Scared, lost? How about lonely? Would you feel like, where's God? Pardon? Helpless? Yeah? All of that. So, very first chapter, Daniel's writing, God is the one who gave Jehoiakim into the hand of the Babylonians. When we're in Babylon, God gave me favor and compassion with these officials. And as far as what they're trying to do to us and the test that Nebuchadnezzar is going to give us, God gave us gifts. So how would that hit you emotionally and whatnot if you're feeling lonely and you think of it in this terms, you see it in this terms, you know it to be in this terms, that God's the one that gave Jehoiakim confidence. What about the loneliness? Why? What's that indicate? God is what? Exactly. He is there and he is not silent. Somebody wrote a book like that. Yes, God, it communicates God's presence. And if you put your feet, if you put yourselves, I guess if you're putting yourselves, you're putting your feet too. But if you put yourselves in the shoes of these young teenagers, that's very reassuring. So who in this first wave, who is he deporting? You're actually getting into one of the questions, one of the last questions under section one. But who is he deporting? What's the text say? Yeah, royal family and what else? What else? Not just Carol, all of you. Y'all here. Yes, yes. The royal family and of the royal family and of the nobility, and as Seth read, the further qualification is they're without blemish, good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge and understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. They're smart, they have good looks, they're polished and poised, and all of that. So, yes, but it is quite a different culture, quite a different language. Joe? Oh, she said, so they might not have been so unprepared. As far as their abilities, they had training and capacities. Yes, and we're going to get into this. This is, we may not get out of these first two questions under section one because this. Because. We're going to be showing how they, something that might reflect their walk with God prior to this captivity. Anyway, so I just wanted to put that out there. I want you to be aware, of how Daniel has arranged this first chapter. I think it's pretty cool the way he has arranged this chapter. Yeah. We were defeated by the Babylonians and they carted us off a long way. And you can't get much more opposite than Babylon from the milieu and the culture that we lived in Judah. Pretty opposite. But even though it doesn't look good on the surface, God is present. We are not alone. God is present with us. Right? And God is there. He's acting gracious. He's providing for his people. Even though it looks like total defeat. Right? So, again, you can read so much from just the way he has structured this chapter. Now, let's get in to this first paragraph. And this first paragraph that the author writes under this first section, I'm talking about page 12 in the workbook, section 1, Daniel and his friends taken into exile. This is the first 7 verses of chapter 1. And his opening paragraph reads, The opening verse sets the stage for Nebuchadnezzar's conquest of Jerusalem. That's verse 1. But what comes next is a bit of a shocker. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Why would Daniel? Now, he asks three questions here. Look at the three questions he asks. Number one, why would Daniel ascribe ultimate responsibility for the capture of Jerusalem to the Lord? Second question, what does this teach us about Daniel's view of God? Third question, and what does this imply about human agency? Okay, CNN, they've got, what's his name? Who's the White House press? Who's the White House reporter for CNN? Acosta. They've got Acosta at Jerusalem. What is he going to report happened? What's the media take on what happened? Who did what? Yeah, he crushed the Israelites, right? That's what's going to show up in the next morning's headlines, okay? Or, on their digital feed, their digital news feeds. That's what's going to show up, but that's not the way Daniel reports it, is it? And because it's not the reality of the situation, right? Why did Daniel ascribe ultimate, when from an outsider's viewpoint, it looks like Nebuchadnezzar, after he defeated the Egyptians in Carchemish, which is by the Euphrates River, north of Israel, and then he came down into Palestine, Syria and Palestine, and conquered Jerusalem, it looked like this, just this hairy-chested, macho brute of the world swept down there and crushed Israel, right? Crushed Jerusalem. That's what it looks like. But Daniel ascribes ultimate responsibility for Jerusalem's fall to the Lord. Why?
What I keep coming back to is, whoever's reading this is going to see that God, number one, is keeping, making true on his promise that if you do not obey me, I'm going to turn my face away. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Serve me, I'll be your God, and so on and so on. If you don't, then here's what you can expect.
Right.
So God is keeping his promise.
Right, exactly.
And the second thing is that in the middle of that, you can take confidence in the fact that no one else is running the show here. So even in exile, you can remember, you can see, and you can trust that this is not out of control.
Yeah. Right, so Seth said two things. He said, you know that God is in control. And then God said he would do it. And absolutely. And I think that second thing is the major reason. Like Seth said, he has said it generally and specifically for a long time. You look in Leviticus chapter 26, verses 33 and 39, and he says, I'm going to pluck you off the land, and I'm going to put you in another land and let you rot. You read those two verses, this is what he says. He says that in verse 39, I'm going to let you rot in the enemy's land. That's a general, that was addressed to the nation at the very beginning of the nation, okay? Then Deuteronomy chapter 28, he lists the consequences for disobeying the covenant. And in verses 63 through 68, he lists the very last consequence, and that is plucking them off the land and sending them into captivity. Okay? So like Seth said, that was stated from the get-go, from the very beginning. That was stated. So that was the general, that was his general statement, I'm going to do it. But it didn't get left to the general statement. And we'll get into the specific statements a little bit later, okay? After we do this next paragraph, but we haven't finished with this first paragraph because I want to take you back and I want to show you the specific statements that he's going to do it. And I want to point out what God did after those specific statements that I found amazing. Anyway, I know I'm being very mysterious here. That's because I don't want to give away the thunder here. But let's just finish that first paragraph. Yeah, God said he was going to do it. He said it in a general way at the beginning of the nation. He said it in a specific way to Hezekiah in 2 Kings chapter 20 and Isaiah 39. And then he said it in a specific way to Judah, directed at Manasseh, and then also in response to Josiah's question. He said it specifically. I'm going to do it now. That's why Daniel said God gave Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, how do you know that? It looks to me like it was the Babylonian army that overran Jerusalem because God said he was going to do it and that he was going to use a foreign army to pluck them off the land and take them away into captivity. And then the second question is, what does this teach us about God's view, about Daniel's view of God? And I think Seth's already answered that question, but did anybody have something written down in answer to that question? You might have something else written down. I'm not saying you can't speak.
I think that you get yourself in a little bit of trouble when you start out trying to apologize for God.
Yeah.
Bad things happen to people.
Yes.
His theological point of view started to quote.
Yes.
Why bad things happen.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, bad things don't happen to good people. I know you didn't, but a famous Jewish theologian did, wrote a book about it. And trouble is there are no good people, right? That's why he doesn't do that to good people. There are none to do it to. Actually, he did it to one good person, right? Yeah. Yes. Right. Daniel's view is that God orchestrated the fall of Jerusalem and Judah. He is sovereign and brings everything to pass. Everything. Can anybody think of a statement that Paul made that's very, very similar to that? Almost identical? As a matter of fact, I might have even got my sentence from that verse. Who knows? You never know. How about Ephesians 1:11? In which Paul says, in him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined, now here it is, according to the purpose of him who works all things according to the counsel of his will. He works all things according to the counsel of his will. Remember the catechism question this morning? What is God? I know you guys got it all memorized. God is the creator and sustainer of everyone and everything. He is something in his perfection and his perfection. He is, why can't I think of that word now? Oh yeah, he is eternal, unchangeable, and what? Yes, infinite, eternal, unchangeable in his power and perfection, goodness and glory, his wisdom, justice and truth. And then the very last statement, nothing happens apart, or except rather, nothing happens except through him and by his will. Where do we get that? Well, Ephesians 1:11 is one of those passages. And it's all throughout the Hebrew, all throughout the Old Testament. Even in Proverbs 16, I believe it's verse 33, Solomon says the roll of the dice is controlled by God. There's nothing random. You know why we call things random? It's because we can't see the forces behind why those things happened. That's why. So it's not accurate to say it's random. What's accurate to say is, I don't know or see what caused that to happen. So anyway, now the third question there can be a bit of a stickler. Did you get what he's asking when he says, what does this imply about human agency? What does he mean by human agency? Human agency is your capacity and function to choose to do something. Okay? You decided to do this and you did it. So it's your functioning. Look at the situation here. Jim Acosta on CNN says that Nebuchadnezzar crushed Jerusalem. Daniel says, no, it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar. It was God himself. He did it. Acosta can say, well, I didn't see God there. I saw Nebuchadnezzar and his army there. Daniel says, no, God was there because he gave Jehoiakim into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. So who did it? That's what he's asking. Who did it? Was it Nebuchadnezzar and his army, or was it God? Who's responsible for the fall of Jerusalem? Who's right, Daniel or Acosta? Yeah.
Nebuchadnezzar took over Jerusalem because there's always a qualifier.
Mm-hmm.
That agency is always, they're like you point out, there's a force behind it. There's an authority behind it. He's subject to something. I was looking at the Acts passage, the same thing about, you know, why was Christ on the cross?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pardon? Yep, and tell us what that says. And who was saying it and to whom was he saying it? Yeah. You meant it for, God meant it for good, you meant it for evil. So here's the answer to the question. They both did it. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar and his army, they did it. They leveled. They defeated Jerusalem. But God was the one ultimately responsible for it. He did it. Here's a teaching in the Old Testament, in the entire Bible, that it's, well, I won't tell you the big $1,000 theological term, but essentially, God, this is what the Bible teaches, God is continually involved with all of his creation, with all of his created things, in such a way that he cooperates with created things in every action. Okay? Now that ends in mystery eventually, okay? That ends in mystery because we can think, okay, so how does God and man cooperate in every single action, or God and animal? Well, it's easy with God and animal. God just directs their instincts, and they do it. It's a little more complicated with man because God gave man freedom. But freedom of choice is simply freedom to do things according to your desires. And so how does God, in that kind of freedom, how does God and man cooperate with each other? Well, you can think a little bit down the road. Think through that a little bit down the road. But then you still do. I don't know. I don't care who you are, even if you're Jonathan Edwards, who wrote an entire essay on that, an entire treatise on that, parts of it are just incredibly dense and hard to understand. Okay? But even Jonathan Edwards, at some point, he hits a brick wall. Because it's above us. But here's the thing. Nebuchadnezzar doing it, God doing it, those two statements don't conflict with each other. There's cooperation. So that's what he's asking there. What does that imply about human agency? And again, here's the comforting thing. Here's what I want you to understand is comforting about that. In this case, Daniel and his friends and all of the other exiles can go away thinking God is the one that did this, so he is present with us. He told us he was going to do this. He warned us from the beginning. He made specific statements about it 100 years ago. He told Hezekiah about this. And just a few years ago, he told Manasseh about that. And right after Manasseh, he told Josiah about it. So God's been talking this up. And he did it. It happened. So we know that he's not just off somewhere and have forgotten us. And we've just fallen prey to the inevitable consequences of Nebuchadnezzar having the biggest and greatest and mightiest army on the earth. That's not what explains this situation. God is here. And in judgment, he gave us over to Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, that's the significance of that. Here's another thing. Just in our daily lives. And that is in, what is it? I think it's 1 Timothy 4:12, 3:12? I can't remember now. Where Paul says, all who desire to live godly will suffer. And that's a big theme with Paul, isn't it? He says over and over again. In Romans 8, we're going to get to that. In verse 15 or 16, he says we're going to suffer as God's children. He gets into in the second half of, he spends some time with it. A few verses later in Romans 8. He talks about it in Philippians. He talks about it in Colossians. Peter talks about it in 1 Peter. James talks about it in James. It's a common theme, Old and New Testament. You desire to follow God, you're going to suffer. You desire to live godly, you're going to suffer. But here's the thing. Because God is orchestrating in some way, he's orchestrating everything that happens. Nothing happens except through him and by his will. Because of that, we know that any bad thing that happens to us or our loved ones is not a gratuitous bad thing. Every difficult, devastating, miserable thing that happens to us, God is using for his purposes. We have that assurance. We're given that insurance implicitly. And so, even when the guy is cutting you off on the freeway, you know, God's there. That just wasn't a gratuitous bad thing that happened. No purpose to it. No direction. Just a random, gratuitous, evil thing that happened. It's not the case. That's what this author is getting at. Okay. I didn't think we'd spend this amount of time on these first three questions. Let's look at that second paragraph. Verse 2 draws, and believe me, we will quicken the pace here. Verse 2 draws considerable attention to the vessels of the house of God, mentioning that they were seized by Nebuchadnezzar and carried off to Babylon. Take a close look at this verse. Given all the things that could have been mentioned, why draw attention to the fate of the temple vessels? Why did he do? Nebuchadnezzar came in, besieged Jerusalem, and captured him, and carried them away. Why, in Daniel's report of this, did he zero in on the temple vessels? That's the first question. Then he goes on. Note as well where they end up in the house of Nebuchadnezzar's God, the treasury of his God, verse 2. What is the significance of this? So why did Daniel zero in on the vessels from the temple of God from the house of God being carried away? And what is the significance that when Nebuchadnezzar got back to Babylon, he put them in the treasury of the temple of his God? What do you have down there for those answers to those two questions? You guys are smart. You have good answers. So just cut loose. Don't worry about it. Dare to be the first one to speak up. Right. Yeah, you can just imagine Nebuchadnezzar going into the treasury of his God and putting those vessels there and go, yeah, Bel, you crushed Yahweh. That's essentially what it is. That's essentially the signal, the sign. That's the way they would view it. It's the way that it was viewed back then. Carol, you got question all written all over you. Pardon? Good question. Pardon? Oh, Carol said, that's why Nebuchadnezzar would find it important. But why would Daniel find it important enough to zero in on the vessels? It's a good question. Why would he? Anybody have an idea? It's something that happened 100 years ago, 100 years before that event. Do you remember Hezekiah invited some Babylonian officials to Jerusalem? You can read it in 2 Kings chapter 20, verses 14 through 19, and Isaiah chapter 39, verses 3 through 8. Let's just look at the Isaiah passage, since we're closer to Isaiah than we are 2 Kings. Isaiah 39, verses 3 through 5. Then Isaiah the prophet came to Hezekiah and said to him, let's just start the first verse. We'll read the first 8 verses so you can get the context. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, not sure that I'm pronouncing that correctly, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent envoys with letters and a present to Hezekiah. For he heard that he had been sick and had recovered. And Hezekiah welcomed them gladly. And he showed them his treasure house, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious oil, his whole armory, all that was found in his storehouses. There was nothing in his house or in all his realm that Hezekiah did not show them. Stop there. That's the context. Now, the historical background here is the hairy-chested, macho brute of the world at that time was Assyria. Babylon was a rising, competing power with Assyria. But Assyria was the power at that time. What had Assyria already done to... what did Isaiah predict that Assyria was going to do? Carry away the Israelites, the northern 10 tribes. Okay, so that's the background here. So probably what is happening here is Isaiah is entertaining these officials from Babylon to form an alliance as a hedge against the bully on the block, Assyria. Okay? So Hezekiah, the Babylonian king sends his son, and Hezekiah shows him all this stuff, just welcomes him, wines and dines him, and shows him everything. Then the next morning, Isaiah shows up at the front porch knocking on the door. Then Isaiah the prophet came to Hezekiah and said to him, what did these men say? And from where did they come to you, Hezekiah? Well, they've come to me from a faraway country, from Babylon, he said. What have they seen in your house? Hezekiah answered, they've seen all that's in my house. There's nothing in my storehouses that I did not show them. I was a great host. Then Isaiah said, I added that last part in case you were wondering. Verse 5, then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that which your fathers have stored up till this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away. And they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then said Hezekiah to Isaiah, the word of the Lord that you have... Hezekiah accepts it so graciously here. Listen to this. Then said Hezekiah to Isaiah, The word of the Lord that you have spoken is good. Why did he say that to Hezekiah? Well, because he was thinking, at least there'll be peace and security in my days. You know, the next generation has to pay for it. That's what we do every election, isn't it? The next generation has to pay for it. Anyway, so that's why it would be of interest to Daniel. Again, notice what's happening here. God was present. Judah was not abandoned. God was not in some far-off room doing whatever, painting happy pictures or anything like that. He was there. And he was fulfilling his word, both the general promises that he's going to do this and the very specific promises that he made to Hezekiah and then 100 years later to Manasseh and to Josiah. And so Daniel was showing that. He, in his report, he was making sure that everybody knew God is present here. He's not absent, and he is doing everything he said he was going to do. Does that make sense, Carol? You've got a question that's just all over your face. I just can't read it.
It's just putting the pieces together from the Isaiah passage and then what Daniel's reporting. Daniel specifically refers to the house of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Isaiah doesn't actually say, I showed them the house of the Lord. Hezekiah didn't say that.
Well, yeah, he did, by implication.
Well, that's what I mean.
It's a clear, it's an explicit statement. Everything.
Right.
So the temple would be included in everything.
So when Daniel says only the house of the Lord, the vessels from the house of the Lord.
Okay, so, but here's the thing to remember. Nebuchadnezzar, the fall of Jerusalem, the captivity of Judah happened in three stages, remember? Here, Daniel reports the first stage. And why do you think he reports the first stage? Just the first stage. That's when he was taken. He was a part of that. So the siege that he refers to, that was probably a very short siege. And it was just some of the vessels. And it was just some of the people. In 587, in 587, Nebuchadnezzar came back. And he took much more of the vessels and the treasure and all of that, and many more people. Ezekiel was one of the ones that was taken in that second stage, and then in the third stage, which was in 586, he sacked Jerusalem, razed it to the ground, burned it, burned the palace, burned the temple, destroyed the walls. And the only people that were left there were the very poor, left to somehow manage the land. So the prophecy was completely fulfilled.
Right.
So Here's a way to think of that. Daniel saying, see, God is doing. He's begun to do what he said he was going to do. And then in the second and third stages of the captivity, it was of the conquest, it was complete. It was thorough. So does that make sense? Yeah. So, but still, in the second and third stages, he was carrying out what God prophesied to Hezekiah. So in all three stages, he was doing what he said he was going to do to Hezekiah. So, and that's why it was of Daniel's interest to point that out, to emphasize it. Okay? Now, obviously, we'll go on to the next paragraph next week, but there's one thing I want to point out, and I will give these passages for you to read, but here's the interesting thing. God gave specific statements that he's going to do this. He gave them not only to Hezekiah, but near the time, he gave it to Manasseh, and then he gave it to Josiah. You remember Manasseh is the evil king in Jerusalem who took Judah's idolatry to an all-time low. And God said, Yahweh says, okay, it's time. You have filled up your sin and idolatry against me. It is time. I am going to take you captive. Okay? You know what the two major things that happened after he said that? Here's the amazing thing. He's saying, you're at an all-time low. You have filled up the full measure of your idolatry, so it is time. I'm going to pluck you off the land and stick you in Babylon. And so the next two major things to happen in Judah is that Manasseh went to prison and he repented fully. That's what I love in 2 Chronicles. I think it's chapter 33. Manasseh's repentance. It's just incredible. I can remember the very first time I read through that. I about fell off my floor. Here is an evil king repenting. I can't believe it. And then he was released from prison. He went back to Jerusalem. He started reforming things and all of that. You know what the next major thing that happened? His grandson, Josiah, became one of the, well, not just one, the greatest king that sought the Lord with all his heart. That's the statement that's made in 2 Kings 23. And it just says it like that. So what's the first question that pops in your mind? What about David? What about some of these others? Well, all I can tell you is this is what 2 Kings 23 says. It says specifically the greatest ever before him and after him to search seek after the Lord his God. And he made major reforms. His reforms were much more thorough than any other king's reforms. Much more thorough than Hezekiah's. Much more thorough than Jehoshaphat's. His reforms were incredibly thorough. And he led a revival. You can read that. And I think that's in 2 Kings 23 as well, that Israel never celebrated, the nation of Israel never celebrated the Passover ever the way they did under Josiah, before him or after him. You know, I'm reading that and I'm sitting here and I'm thinking this. Okay, God's had it with Judah. They have filled up the full measure of their idolatry, and he's going to take them into captivity. And so the next thing he does is he causes Manasseh. He brings Manasseh to the point of repentance, and Manasseh starts changing everything. And then he raises up Manasseh's grandson, and he carries out these reforms and this revival like has never been seen in that nation. What is God doing? I thought he was going to take this nation captive. What's going on here? Well, I'll give you these passages so you can look at them yourself in a moment here. But let me suggest this, and we'll go into more of it next week, because I want to really drill down on this. It's implications for you and I. Here's what I think is happening. After Judah had filled up the full measure of their idolatry and sin against God, then he took them into a period where he was preparing them spiritually for the captivity. Let me give you one piece of evidence of that. Verse 8. Where did Daniel and his three friends get the resolve that they showed in verse 8? You know, they just didn't sniff that up out of the Babylonian air. That resolve not to defile themselves. Where did they get that? They were 15. That's Chris, that's Ian, that's Sam. Where did they get that kind of resolve? Here's my point. Those four Jewish teenagers would have lived their first 10 or 11 years, probably their first 11 years in the reign of Josiah. 4 years later, they're carried off to Babylon. And we see what God did in the lives of those young boys as they were living in the times of reform and revival under King Josiah. And that has tremendous implications for all of us here. So you think about that. We'll talk about that when we come back next week. The fact that those four youths grew up in a time of unparalleled spiritual reform and revival in the nation of Judah. And then we see what they did in this book. I don't think that's just simply coincidence. And just putting those things together is why I haven't read anybody else saying this. Maybe I'll stumble on somebody else. But my conclusion from all of that is that after he decided to take Judah into captivity, then God turned his attention to preparing them spiritually for captivity. And so there would have been a good reception for Jeremiah's letter to the exiles that we read last week in Jeremiah 29. So you think about that. And you think about what that implies about us, the church, and the kids growing up in our midst. And all of that. And we'll talk about that next week.